You're tuned to Perspectives, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday right here on KTEP. Good afternoon. I'm Louis Sines, your host for Perspectives, and joining us today is my colleague Sita Arocha. Sita is a professor here on campus in the communication department, but she's here because she recently has accomplished something that is very honorable, and the fact going to graduate school when you have a full-time job and a family is even harder, which is what I did and she did, but she also accomplished something that she've always wanted to do. Sita, thank you very much for being with us here today.
Thank you, Louis. It's a pleasure.
Now, as I mentioned, you did something that you always wanted to do. You had always hoped to write a book about you leaving Cuba.
Yeah, always, actually. And I think since I was a child, I always thought about, you know, what is it about my life that makes it different from other people's lives? But then the older I got and the more I started working as a journalist and doing stories about immigration, I realized, you know, that mine is one of millions of stories of newcomers to the United States, especially, you know, over the last 50 years of immigrants who've come here looking for different things, you know, economic stability, freedom, I mean, just like our forefathers did. And that there are so many other people who are sharing that same story. And I wanted, in a way, to tell the story in a way that they could connect with. So my book, which is called Adios Cuba, Hello Buddha, and I can talk a little bit more later about why I gave it that title. But the book is really more about the struggle of all new Americans to fit in and the questioning of who am I now that, you know, I'm no longer in the old country, but I'm now in America. And how do people see me? And how do I start to see myself, you know, as a Cuban American or Hispanic American?
And, you know, we hear stories about immigrants from, and I hate to say the old days because it sounds like it was a long, long time ago. But, for example, in the 1930s, 1920s, the book that comes to mind, one of my favorite books is A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. And it's about this little girl who's narrating the fact that she's an Irish immigrant. And the Irish are very much discriminated against in New York. But then she realizes that she's not alone because there are other groups of immigrants and they're all discriminated against. But she's also talking about, okay, this is a new country, it's a new life. Supposedly, our grandparents say we're going to have a better opportunity. You left Cuba, I believe, you said 2 years before the revolution
started?
Yes,
that's right, yes.
And so, obviously, your parents knew something was coming, your family knew something was going on, and they said, let's get out of here. Did you ever hear that later or at the time you asked, why are we leaving?
Yeah, actually, Louis, our story as Cuban immigrants in 1957, because like you said, it was 2 years before the Cuban Revolution, we're not typical of Cubans who are fleeing Cuba for political reasons. And actually, my family fled. It was really for economic reasons, because of poverty. My father was one of nine brothers and sisters. His father and my grandfather had been tenant farmers in a little town called Guira de Melena, which is in the province of Havana, but about 40 minutes away from the capital city. My mother was the daughter of a small town police officer in the same little town, Guira de Melena. They were kind of lower middle class people. And so when they married and they had two children right away, basically my father was working for a plantation owner there hauling fruits and vegetables across the island. And so this was 57, and he was earning pretty much a dollar a day, and he was working 7 days a week. And he and my mom hardly ever saw each other. And sometimes she would go with him on some of his overnight trips that he had to take. And so at some point, and I think it really was my mother, who was a very strong woman, who said to him, look, we're not going anywhere. We have to get out of here if we want to create a better life for us and our children. And my mother had an aunt who had immigrated to Tampa, Florida, back in the 1910s or the 20s. She'd married a barber from Tampa. This was my Aunt Carmen. And Aunt Carmen, she was middle class because her husband became a barber. He had his own barber shop. And she invited my mother to come to be with her in Tampa in the United States. And My mother, as a young woman, was afraid to go, but then once she married, she wrote my aunt and said, you know, I want, Thea Carmen, I want to take you up on that opportunity. I don't see much of a chance here for myself and my children and my husband, so we want to come. We're going to take you up on that offer. So when we came, we came as sponsored, legal sponsored immigrants through my aunt Carmen. And then my father right away got work as a roofer in Tampa. You can imagine pitching tar roofs under 100-degree, weather in Tampa, Florida. My mother went to work in factories. She worked as a seamstress for a while. She worked in a cigar rolling factory for a while. So my parents were working class. They always were. And as a result, that's how we were raised. You know, a lot of hard work, a lot of dedication to school, looking at the future, looking at education as the future for the children in our family.
Were you ever afraid, or did you look back and say, I'm glad we left when we did, or were you too young?
No, absolutely. And there's an irony there in the story, and it's in the book. And it turns out that somehow my parents went back to Cuba in 59, early 59, for Christmas. They went to see my grandmother. At that point, we were legal. We were in the process of becoming legal residents of the United States. And so we got there for Christmas and New Year's, and on New Year's Day, Batista left, the dictator left, fled the country. The revolutionaries came down from the mountains and came into the city and took over the government. They closed the airport, and we were supposed to leave, go back to Florida, our home then at that point, sometime around the middle of January after our Christmas vacation in Cuba with my grandmother and other relatives. And they closed the airport. We couldn't get out. There were milicianos all over the place. Some Castro soldiers came to my grandmother's house because my grandfather, as I mentioned, had been a policeman under the Batista dictatorship. And they thought that we had weapons hidden in the house. And they wanted to come in and search the house. My grandmother, who was about 4'9", stood in the doorway, and she said to these two guys, you're coming in here over my dead body. Nobody comes into my house. There was indeed a gun in the house, which they then promptly buried in the backyard. At that point, my mother and father didn't know if we were going to be allowed to leave. We thought, you know, maybe we have to stay here. And actually, at that point, my father, who was very tied to his family, wanted to stay. And my mother said, no, we're about to become Americans, and our children's future is in Florida, and as we're going to get the hell out of here as soon as we can. And so when they reopened the airport, which is in the latter part of January, then we were among the first ones because we had our visas and everything, all our legal papers, we were able to get out. But then that was it. And, you know, I always tell people that technically I wasn't in exile because we left in 57 and we left voluntarily. But being there during the revolution and leaving at the beginning of the revolution, we couldn't go back. We could not go back. And so for the next 20 years, both grandmothers died. We had horrible tragedies in our family. My father, I remember trying to get back to Cuba to see sometime in the mid-60s when his mother died, just to see her on her deathbed and then be there for the funeral. There was no way to go back. And so that part of our life was completely, it was like, you know, a solid brick wall. It was closed to us. We had no contact with that part of our life anymore. And that was very, very tragic. So in that sense, I feel like an exile.
Exile.
Yeah.
Did you have trouble because of the fact that as a journalist you're set on writing something about this? Or was it getting used to writing about yourself, which is, you know, we're not used to doing that?
Absolutely. It was such a struggle. I mean, it took me 5 years to write this book, and it took me 5 years to go through the master's program here in creative writing because I was working, of course, full time, and then also writing the book and taking classes. But so it was a process of, you know, kind of beating the journalist out of me. And I remember my professors in the MFA program telling me, Zita, you write like a journalist. Stop writing like a journalist. You know, open up your writing. Be more expansive. Describe more. Don't be afraid to put the I into the story, you know. And I struggled with that, and I struggled with that. And I actually, what I did was I wrote separate chapters. Like I wrote a chapter on my aunt, Aunt Carmen. I wrote a chapter on my grandmother. I wrote a chapter about my grandfather. I wrote a chapter about my parents and their early lives in Cuba. And there were all these chapters all over the place. And then, again, I was still struggling with, okay, I was just recounting my story chronologically, right? As we all tend to do when you're writing your life story. But that really wasn't the truth of my story. The truth lay elsewhere. So I had to really think about not only break myself of the habit of writing like a journalist, attribution, all the facts, right, all that, take myself out of it, but also how was I going to structure this massive amount of material? Because I also, when Cuba did reopen the doors and reestablish contact with the United States back in the early 80s, I began to go back to Cuba to visit. My grandparents were all dead by that time, but I still had aunts and uncles and cousins, and they all lived in the same little town, Guida de Melena. And so I began to travel back every few years, both as a journalist and both as just family member to see my family. So I began to collect a lot of material. I began to do interviews with family members, began to take pictures, began to take audio recordings. I have a massive amount of material. So how do you shape that? How do you shape that? And journalists are, as you said before, you know, you get to the facts, you get to the lead, you tell the story in as few words as possible, and it's over. And that's not the way it is when you're writing creative nonfiction in the format of a memoir. It's very, very different.
One of the things that you mentioned was your mother talking about the fact that we need to get out of here. We need to go with Tia Carmen, and we need to get away. And as you said, your parents were hardworking American families, and there are a lot of hardworking American families here in this country who don't get recognized for everything they do. And as you mentioned, being an immigrant from Cuba, especially around this area, when we think of immigrants, we think of Mexico,
right?
Period. And there are immigrants from all over the world, as you just said earlier. And the fact that, as one banker recently at a forum that I emceed here said, we have to get it out of our minds as Americans, both Republican and Democrat, that all immigrants are not crooks. They're people trying to make a better living.
Absolutely. No, and I think that that is a compelling story that needs to be told by the press, because when media usually writes about immigrants, it is in that fashion. You know, oh, immigrants are taking jobs away from Americans, or, you know, immigrants are committing crimes, or, you know, some immigrants are waiting to be deported because, you know, they, you know, have 3 arrest warrants or something or whatever. So you tend to see in the media oftentimes those kinds of stories played up rather than the truth about immigrants in our country, which is that they're the salt of the earth. They're there. They're working our restaurants. They're cooking our food. They're picking our food. They're cleaning our hotel rooms. They are, mowing our lawns. They're raising our children. When I was in Washington, I was shocked to find out that most of the nannies working in upper middle class households in our nation's capital were immigrants from Latin America. And, you know, these were women who had left their own little children at home under less than favorable conditions with their mothers or their grandmothers so that they could come to America, earn a few dollars so they could send it back to their kids so the kids could have milk and tortillas to eat, you know? And we lose sight of that fact. And I think that we oversimplify the story of immigrants in America. We don't see the story with all the nuances and the complexity that it needs to have. And the fact that as a nation, we are dependent on these people to have our society function, you know?
Getting back to your father, you describe him a little bit, and he's not a big fan of Fidel Castro.
No.
That he calls him a son of a something, okay.
Yep.
What did you learn from your father and your mother about Fidel Castro? Because when you left, again, you were young, but as you grew, I mean, Fidel Castro was very dominant as far as being a man in the news,
yeah,
in charge, etc.
Yeah, absolutely. No, my parents, my dad just passed away last year at age 88, and he, He thought he was going to outlive Castro, but he didn't, right? We think he's still alive. My mother is still alive, and their whole lives, they were very much anti-Castro. And there was tension and conflict between us when I was a young woman in college. I went to college in Tampa, Florida, at University of South Florida. And so I sided with Castro, knowing where my father came from, knowing that he was earning a dollar a day, knowing he was working for some rich hacendados who didn't treat their workers in the way that they should have been treated. I sided with the revolution, and I thought that Castro was definitely a champion of the, they call them guajiros, the poor, the blacks and the poor whites, the poor farmers in Cuba. And so that created a lot of conflict with my family, with my mom and dad. And for a number of years, we didn't really speak about politics, you know, when I was around them, because I knew exactly where they stood, and they just thought that Castro was awful for Cuba. And then this is kind of ironic, too. So I went to work in Miami for the El Miami Herald at the time, Spanish paper, and I was in the fire, so to speak, because Miami in those days was a hotbed of activity against Castro, and there was all kinds of, there were bombings and there were shootings and they were targeting any Cuban that they thought was too pro-Castro, too leftist. And I was in the middle of this writing news stories about this. And one time, my parents were home in Tampa listening to one of the radio stations from Miami, and the newscaster says, and called me by name, because he considered that my coverage, my objective reporting in the El Miami Herald was slanted towards Castro, even though I was writing about two farming families, one that was pro-Castro and another one that was anti-Castro, and how they were faring. And so this newscaster over the radio said, and this Zita Arocha that appeared in the paper today and wrote this scurrilous article about Cuban farmers, we're going to find out who she is and where she is, and we're going to go after her. And so my mother was absolutely terrified, and she called me up and on the phone, and she said, you know, do you realize what they're saying about you? You know, are you in any danger? And maybe you should think about switching professions, you know. So I was definitely in the middle of that generational conflict between the anti-Cuban older generation and then the new, more progressive Cubans that were thinking, you know, he's trying to do some good things for the country. Things weren't peachy keen back when Batista was there, right? He was oppressing the poor, and he was reaping a lot of money off the backs of the poor, and was in cahoots with the mafia. So that, I think, created a lot of tension in my upbringing.
Let me ask you a little bit about, since you mentioned Castro, what about, what did your family or what did you think about the JFK administration and also particularly the Bay of Pigs and the Cuban Missile Crisis?
It's so interesting to me, Louis, because a lot of Cubans still to this day really like JFK. Because he took on Castro, and, you know, never mind the fact that we almost went into a nuclear war over it. But I think that there are generally pretty good feelings about Castro. But I've also found that with a lot of Cubans from the old school, right, the ones that fled the revolution because they lost property or they lost businesses, and they were rightly so very angry about what had happened to them. But what I found is that, and I always wondered, well, why weren't they more angry with JFK? Because at Bay of Pigs, he basically pulled back on supporting the rebels, right? Didn't give them the air support they needed to have been able to really go into Cuba and invade and take it back, right? I have heard very few Cubans say, you know, oh, you know, JFK, he really, you know, messed up. He should have done that. So I don't really know. Sometimes I wonder about how people interpret history and whether they interpret it in ways in which they want to believe it. Do you know what I mean? They see it that way, not as it was.
His perspective.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Lack of perspective. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Now, you Before you decided to finally, I want to say finally, and because I know that's what I said, finally I'm going to start writing this, I think. And I had stacks and stacks of books and all this research, and I'm sure you did too. You went to Colorado.
Yes.
Why did you choose to go to Colorado to write?
To write my book, yeah. Well, that was a very interesting story too, and I think it's a part of the book, as you mentioned before. There's a Buddhist retreat center in southern Colorado. My daughter had started going there when she was in college because she was writing for some class projects. She was writing about American women in Buddhism and what they'd created, and it turned out that the founder of the center called Tara Mandala is a woman, American woman who went to Tibet as a very young woman, became a nun, and then over the years then came back to the United States and then helped bring Buddhist practices to America. So I started going there with my daughter, and they have retreat cabins there. And the retreat cabins are very rustic. They are separated from, you know, very far away from the community center or the temple and everything. No running water, no toilets. There's an outhouse, no electricity, just very, very basic and very close to the earth, so to speak. And I really decided that because of my intense life, 5 years in this MFA program, struggling with my book, all of that I do at UTEP in terms of the programs that I run and my teaching load and everything, that I really needed to just step back, clear my mind, and immerse myself in the material that I had. So what I did is I went there over a summer, and that's what I did. I took my computer. My husband bought me a solar collector. He spent about $900-something on this solar collector that soldiers use in the desert. They carry with them in the desert so that they can have, you know, some electricity for their phone or whatever. And so I spent a month there. And I spent a month. I took all I took boxes of books, notebooks, videos, my audio recordings, pictures from when we were kids. And I just surrounded myself by all this stuff. And I just threw myself into the writing. And so part of my book is about the process of writing the book, because it was so hard. It was so hard to put it in perspective. It was hard to figure out, what do I want to say? What do I really want this book to be about? And in the end, I found out that the book was really about death. It was about exile being like a death for immigrants. That you cut off the past, you come to a new life. You're not sure how you fit into the new life, and you're in this in-between state where you don't really have an identity, so to speak. You have to kind of rediscover your identity. And then while I was in this cabin, I also was doing a lot of reading about Tibetan Buddhism. And there's an idea in Buddhism called the bardo, B-A-R-D-O. And what that is it's, you know, Buddhists believe in that people come back life after life until have a chance to reach enlightenment. But there, when you die, there is an in-between state called the bardo. And that's the in-between state between when you die and when you're reborn as another person. And so what I did was, while I was in there in that cabin reading and thinking about these ideas, I thought, exile is like being in the bardo. You've left your old life behind, right? You no longer have much of a connection with it. You have memories, but you're not quite fully engaged yet in your new life. And I think that some immigrants, like in the case of my parents, they stay in the bardo their whole life. They never really quite fully accept their new American reality and identity. It's too hard for them. It's too painful. In some cases, they prefer to live in memory, in the land of memory. In the case of my mother, she was a woman who was never really living in the present, but was always thinking about, I'll get there someday. I'll get there someday. You know, we have to save money to buy a house. We have to save money to send our kids to college. She was always thinking about the future. My struggle was to integrate those two things, to get past this intermediate stage and to say, you know what? I'm an American now. I am an American. I'm an Hispanic American, but I am an American and I belong here. And I think that that's where many immigrants are going. And as the generations pass, it becomes easier then for the children and the grandchildren to be able to say that, okay, this is who I am now. This is my identity. I'm an Hispanic American.
Being raised Cuban American as you came to the United States, you were, I would imagine, Roman Catholic?
No.
Most Cubans?
No, we totally break the mold. My parents were Catholic. No, my mother was Catholic in Cuba. My dad was Presbyterian. And I was raised in a very conservative Christian household. We went to a missionary church. And my parents are both strong born-again Christians, and I was raised in that.
So then when you say, because the name of your book is Adios Cuba, Hello Buddha, is that because of your past, you say goodbye to your past, but then you were also introduced to Buddhism, or did you already know a little bit from your daughter Miranda?
I knew a little bit from Miranda, but just what she told me. But I really became immersed in the philosophy, the practice, the ideas. And I'm in my book, I'm able to use Buddhism as a frame to come to terms with my past. And because, again, the concepts, and I took that idea of the bardo, being in that in-between, and I said, you know, that fits who I am, and that fits where I've been. And so I was able to use that and incorporate that into my story.
And again, as you know, you and I discussed, I stereotyped you also as being a Cuban Catholic, and it's completely different what you just told me. And a lot of people tend to do that about
yes.
immigrants. They're, you know, they're Mexican, then they must be this. They're Irish, so they must be this. They're Jewish, so they must be that, etc. But it's all different. Now, is the book, because I know you wrote that as part of your master's thesis as well. Is it available already as a book or not yet?
I think it's available in the library at UTEP as a PDF file. Yeah, it's part of the process when you've, it's a thesis.
Mm-hmm.
It was submitted as a thesis. I am in the process of final editing it. I just rewrote the last two chapters, and I'm working on the epilogue, bringing the story up to date, because my father died last year, and he was a huge part of my life. He was a poet. He was a Cuban farmer, a Cuban poet, beautiful man, so I want to reflect that in my book. So the next step now is, once it's all edited, it's going to go out to agents. And if any one of you guys listening to Louis' show, if you know of an editor, or not an editor because I have an editor, but if you know of an agent who might be interested in a memoir about a Cuban-American experience, about the issue of immigration and about identity as immigrants, please call Louis and let him know. And I'll follow up on it, because that's the next step for my book. And I really hope to see it published. But you know what? If for some reason I can't get a big publisher to publish it, I'm not afraid, and I'm more than willing to, and I'm looking into e-publishing as well.
Well, Sita, thank you very much for being with us here today. We've been visiting with Sita Rocha, one of my colleagues, and as I mentioned before, the name of her thesis is Adios Cuba, Hello Buddha, and you can download it as a PDF file from the UTEP library, and that's what I did to read it. Sita, thank you very much for being with us here
today. Thank you, Louis. It's been a pleasure.
Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer and producer, Dennis Wu. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sines.